This is Infants on Thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Listener Essay.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. My name's Tom Perry. Today I'm joined with my friend Jake, who submitted a listener essay titled Verbal Jiu-Jitsu. And in this episode, Jake invited Kim Gustafson to also join in with us. Kim is the principal of Ascendio, a company whose focus is improving methods of communication in the corporate sector. So take it away, Jake.
Howdy, y'all. My name is Jake. I'm a small-town Utah dude that grew up drinking from the Mormon fire hose. For years, I felt as if I was pretty big deal, save for the last days and all, and one of the tougher members of a chosen generation. Then they started saying the same thing about or to you X, Y, and Z kids. That is why I quit paying tithing and quit going to church. Okay, I'm kidding. My disaffection for Mormonism runs a little deeper than just that, but it does suck not to feel like a big deal anymore. I mean, if the coach just would have put me in, I bet I could throw a football over that mountain, right? So on a serious note, one sentiment I hear repeatedly in the podcast world is that it's semi-impossible to have a productive conversation with the TBM. Over the last year or so, I would have agreed with this paradigm. It wasn't until recent that I started applying a different paradigm to this question. You see, I'm a safety professional. I spend my days engaged in heated conversation about how to change behaviors, cultures, and sometimes standards. I've always called this method of conversation with an opposing foe verbal jiu-jitsu. Not until recent have I thought to apply this technique to the opposition of Mormonism. So what do I mean by jiu-jitsu? Well, let's just start by unpacking the language. Verbal, basically language, jiu, can be translated to mean gentle, soft, subtle, or supple, flexible, pliable, or yielding. And jitsu can be translated to mean the art or technique of manipulating an opponent's forces against him or herself rather than direct confrontation. To sum it up, it's turning an opponent's verbal energy against them. When I teach this technique to other safety professionals, I basically sum up the lesson by saying, when your verbal enemy is making mistakes, get out of their way. I also add, it's also helps to entice them down the path with good questions. The key to this verbal tactic is to keep your own balance. I realized recently that this is something I have lacked greatly in regards to my own faith transition. Over the last 2 years, I've engaged in conversations with family and friends. I've basically been an asshole. I've spoiled a few relationships. Now that I am calmed down a bit, I have got into the what now mindset and have gotten into the what now mindset. I realize that I have a few things in my pocket that I have overlooked, or better said, I believe there may be a better way to continue existing in this culture without succumbing to a-holery. How, you ask? Well, let's get into it a little bit. Like I said, I'm an HSE professional, and this is not a self-imposed title. I actually have a piece of validating paper that says so. So corporate safety and religion have a ton in common. They both have commandments, power structures, and cultures, which is all based off of their own doctrine. Well, long story short, it didn't take me long to realize that OSHA doesn't keep a person safe. It does help by holding the threat of a fine over a company's head, but most regs are so vague that you can almost make them say whatever you want. Kind of sounds familiar. To me, it does. And many safety professionals do. Science based in trial and error has proven that people hurt people. More specifically, behaviors hurt people. So what is the ultimate goal of a safety professional? To affect change in people by focusing on their behaviors. How do we do this? Language, or I call it jiu-jitsu. I believe a true safety professional's job is more like being a motivational psychologist. Now, how do I now apply this to ex-Mormonism? The main concept in jiu-jitsu is finding your own balance. After pulling a little taffy and doing the gainer off the boat, I was not in a state of mind to have either a healthy nor productive conversation with the TBM. felt emotionally pissed and needed to find my feet. I needed to observe and pontificate. Can't even say it. Yes, I said pontificate. My reaction to the words being used by these TBMs. I needed to have a better reaction to the TBM guilt darts. As a side note, I'm certain Matt Long gets this concept. I loved his comments in the Church Court of Love discussion. Why would you think I'd need to record this, and why would you be afraid of any recording? Great minds, I guess. I don't think you even caught it, Glenn. I think you may have been caught up in those thoughts of how awesome you are. Long story short, Jiu-Jitsu is the art of engaging in productive conversations, conversations in which all parties are accountable to and for their own words. So how does it work? Well, let me just give a few simple steps one can take to have a healthy conversation with a TBM. Step one, good questions, open-ended questions. After the guilt darts start flying, aka, wow, why would you say it that way? That comment had some pepper on it. Let's break down and talk about it if we can. Step two, get a notepad and a pen. Write down the comments on paper. This does a few things. Keeps the TBMs on topic and keeps them accountable to their words. Step three, probably the most important step, make it clear that you're okay and maybe even hoping to be wrong, but just can't see how. AKA, Chief, I want to be wrong about my lack of belief in this. Based on what I've learned, I just don't understand how. Would you be so kind to walk me through it? There's a lot more to it than these simple three simple steps, but I feel for the sake of fitting it into a small segment of time, it pays to be a little brief. I've begun having great conversations with certain family members as of late. I believe this is because I've deployed jiu-jitsu tactics at the beginning of the conversations. Right out of the gate, most conversations begin with these TBM guilt darts being fired at me. Examples, I don't know why you think you can't baptize your own son. I sure wish you would wake up to the fact that you're not going to be with your family in the next life. And isn't that important to you? I absorb them for a time, but fire back a few sincere questions. I usually simply say, Chief, stop right there and let me grab a notepad. When I show back up, I have already have these phrases written on the paper. Then I say, I'm really hoping to be wrong about all this, but I'd like your help in showing me how. When you said baptize my own son, what did you mean by that? I then listen. Experience has proven to me at this point, most will either engage in a non-defensive manner or disengage from the conversation. Number one, be willing to listen and take the conversation serious. Take notes and don't get emotional or react to the darts. I'm certain it's possible to have productive and empathy-filled conversations with our believing family and friends if we find our balance and engage in some of these simple ground rules. Hope you're all doing good. And Matt or Glenn, sorry for offending you. Peace out. Bye.
Joined with Jake, who submitted an essay, and we're also joined with Kim, who is an expert on communications. Well, we'll just let him tell us what his expertise is. So let's start with you, Kim. Why don't you tell us who you are, where you're from, and a little bit of background and what your expertise is and mission statement.
Sure. So my name is Kim Gustafson, and by the sound of my voice, some people may start thinking Kim, and it may sound like a guy, and yes, I am a guy. I'm born and raised in Sweden. I'm born and raised in Sweden, where that's actually a male name, so that's my heritage. I've been in the United States for close to 30 years. I have a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of California of Irvine. I have studied seven languages, and my specific work and field of study, one could say, for the last 33 years has been around the impact of language on people, cultures, behaviors, and actions. oh, that was my reminder to get on this call. And yeah, exactly. Here I am, right? It's a good thing we have Outlook today. Anyway, my specific work is inside of corporations, and my commitment is that global corporations lead the way in creating a world of integrity, equality, human and civil rights for all people. And it was inside of some work that I did in Wyoming in an oil corporation in the field of safety that I met Jake. So our program and the work I do deals with human effectiveness as a bottom line. And Jake and I were in a conversation around the impact of the safety professionals on people in operations. And Jake then took everything from the course and applied it in many areas of his life. I think that pretty much says it all.
Awesome.
Maybe two other pieces about me is I've studied 7 languages. I am not fluent in all of those. And I've visited 86 countries.
Holy crap. That's a resume in and of itself.
So,
didn't awesome. You just get back from Azerbaijan or Saudi Arabia or something like that last time I touched base with you, Kim?
The latest trip I did was an around, or biggest one was an around the world trip where I visited, I think it was 8 countries in 30 days, including Myanmar, where I was actually in Rangoon on the day Aung San Suu Kyi got elected she can't be the president, but she her party won election. So that was a phenomenal day and the history of humankind.
So before we get into it too much, I got to ask, do you have a particular favorite place?
I have many favorite places, Tom. Okay. I have many favorite places. It all depends on what you're looking for. For me, I find my connection to, if you want to call it a higher power or whatever, mostly in nature. So I'm a nature guy. I love beautiful settings, and you can find those in cities like Rio. You can also, you know, out in the forest or in a mountaintop or on a beach. So there are many places. Tahiti is probably one of those that will stay in my heart forever, traveling around Bora Bora on a little skiff with a guy playing the... what's it called now? The little small guitar. Anyway, that's one of my favorite memories around that. So there's,
that's cool.
Yeah.
So is Italy on your map?
Italy's on my map. I spent 5 weeks there, after my first year in college, traveling around by train.
Yeah. That's the one place that I often kind of feel like I'm drawn to. I haven't been there yet, but I just love the history. You know, it's just like, man, that'd be a really cool place to soak in.
It is. I would highly recommend it.
Cool.
And you can't go wrong with the food there.
That's what I hear. That's what I've heard. Okay, so kind of pushing this back into the Mormon kind of theme here, Jake and I met up and had lunch, and he was talking to me about submitting this as an idea for an episode about how we can build bridges verbally with each other, even though sometimes it seems like so many of us are worlds apart. There's believers, there's non-believers, and how can we find common ground? How can we build bridges with each other and really find mutual ways of understanding, then rather than just falling into the acceptance like, well, they're over here and I'm over here and that's that. And then just kind of isolate ourselves from each other, even though sometimes literally we're living in the same house with each other. And as Jake and I were talking about this, I was like, this is phenomenal, because I live in a mixed faith marriage right now. My wife is a believer. I'm a non-believer. And more times than not, communication is probably the number one problem or issue that we sometimes face, because, you know, she has a different set of morals and standards and values, and I have mine that's different. And sometimes they collide in every way, shape, or form when it comes to the kids or whatever. And so this topic, personally for me, and I think it's universal, it's not just Mormons, obviously, but trying to find ways to find a common ground with each other through communication is so, so important. So, Jake, why don't you kind of, for a minute, talk about why this came to the top of your mind, how you wanted to bring this up, present this as an idea, which I love, and bringing Kim in. So talk a little bit about that.
Pretty much the last, I'd say, 3 years, my disaffection, or my, I don't know what the going term is today, my eye-opening experience over the last 3 years, listening to a lot of podcasts, I've heard tons of discussion about just the affirmation, let me back up. In my job as a safety professional, there's a term called root cause analysis. It's like when somebody does an accident happens, you go in and you actually start whittling down by interviewing people and communicating with people, dissecting equipment, whatever, to find what is at the very root of this event, and how do we mitigate this in the future. Safety individuals' profession, you have to understand how to get to the root of things, and they're always kind of seeking what is at the root. And I did that with religion. Well, again, one of the big eye-opening events in my life was sitting in Kim's class, and real diverse group. And I was pretty, I mean, I felt like I was open, but in hindsight, I had a chip on my shoulder in this class. I wasn't real quiet in the class, was I, Kim? I always thought I had something to say, at least.
You did.
Well, at one point he was going through a thing called the blame game. And I was just basically trying to, how I learn is I translate into my own words. And to me, just living in the common world and religion, that line was not very, I was always bouncing back and forth, like using common beliefs and religion in my safety world. And at one point when Kim said, listen, in order to have a conversation with somebody, you got to abandon this idea. Again, I'm paraphrasing Kim, but you got to abandon this idea of right and wrong. And I just about flipped out of my chair, and I'm like, are you saying there's no such thing as right and wrong? And the class kind of erupted, and I was very defiant. And then he broke it down, just explained, look, if you come into it with a bias, basically, you're never gonna bridge anything or have a conversation with anyone. And that was a big turning point for me to open my eyes to, well, this is my profession now. I have to be able to go up and have conversations with people I don't exactly like, or I don't see eye to eye with, or I don't get along with. Because that's my job. That's what I get paid to do. And there happened to be somebody in the class with us that was a peer that I just didn't get along with. And we'll get into that part of the story. What was the question again, Tom? Sorry.
How this became an idea
okay. To
present as an episode. Yeah, yeah.
So about a year ago, when I really started chewing on the Mormon bark and went through the whole stages of anger and betrayal, and everyone that I had a conversation with that was a true believing Mormon, we just locked horns. Like I was pretty fueled to, in some cases, tell them how bigoted and dumb and ignorant and
how wrong they were.
Yeah. And I severed a relationship with my brother for quite a while, where we just couldn't talk to each other because of my inability to just have a respectful, generative conversation. I just would start pounding the table, and it wasn't until those emotions kind of subsided that I really started like thinking, well, I could apply some of my conversational techniques that I learned from Kim in my religious world or my non-religious world now. Because I'm very similar to you. I have a true believing, my wife's family are all dyed in the wool and very true believing, including my wife. And we, for about a year, have had a real difficult time having conversations. And I was just complying to comply. And at one point, she got so sick of me going to church with her because of me being an antagonist that she came up to me and said, maybe you ought to sit this next one out, Chief. Like you're becoming a very unhappy person. So long story short, fast forward to about a month ago, I strategically sat down at an event with my father-in-law, who is very wanting to talk me back into the church type thing. And it turned in initially to a kind of it was going down the brother route, the same type of conversation I'd had with my brother. And I had pre-thought it, but I tactically went in and grabbed a notebook and wrote down some of the little Mormon dart phrases he was saying. And I could tell he was defensive, but he was still kind of shooting the, hey, you're going to go to hell, and don't you want to, why didn't you baptize your son, and blah, blah, that type of thing. And we just started like getting present with each other. Like, what do you mean by that? Like, I want to understand, and I'm okay being wrong. Just started applying some of the techniques that Kim had taught me that were already habit. I just never thought to apply them in this setting. And it turned out we had an awesome conversation. We talked for about 2 hours, and all the ladies were walking up and trying to listen in to see if we were fighting with each other. And we had to keep turning to them and saying, hey, this is good. Like, everybody chill out, just go play. We're good. Let us talk.
Right.
And, in fact, I'll read you a text I got from I wish my father-in-law a happy Father's Day. And, he texted me about an hour ago and said, are we going to continue that conversation?
Oh, that's great.
Because we have a family reunion coming up here in about a week.
There you go.
And I said, of course, yeah, we can definitely. I can't think of a better Father's Day present to give to each other than let's keep talking about this stuff. So there it is. There's all my background. And I'd never been online or been on Facebook, but I made an attempt to get on Facebook to look up Tom so I could just tell him about this and say, is this useful? Is this something that we could share with everybody that's kind of in our same boat? And
which is hilarious, because I think you already knew the answer to that question, because it's been so effective for you that it's like, yeah, of course, you know, applying these techniques or these principles in our daily lives in all sorts of avenues, you know, not just religious, but obviously with, you know, your business and stuff like that, it's incredibly valuable. What do you think about that, Kim? I mean, do you feel like that you're teaching life techniques, so you're not just helping people in the corporate world, but you're actually helping people in their personal lives too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the work that I do and the principles, and if you want to call it models I use, come from a field and our proprietary nature and all that kind of stuff that I've been studying since I was 18 years old. And they are life techniques. It just happens that in my work, I work in the corporate world. So I don't do courses for individuals or whatever. However, one of the things that many times have corporations keep re-engaging me is that their employees find so much value in the conversations we're having in the corporate environment, in their personal lives that they want additional programs. And,
finish that and then I'll chime in.
No, you know, sometimes there is, trainings corporations have, and one of the feedbacks I've gotten and questions I've gotten from time to time by people inside of corporate training departments is, what is it you do that has people want more of your stuff? Because when we put on programs, we have to drag people into our courses and into the seats. And when you come and you do something, they want more of it. And not only do they want more of it, they want their friends or colleagues to do it as well.
Right.
So no, Tom, it's the principles are applicable universally. So like I said earlier, Jake and I, we worked in a specific setting inside of the intent of the program was actually to create partnership between the safety advisors and operations in this particular region. And the traditional relationship, and this can go between, parents and children. It could go between in-laws and, whatever you look at. But it can be an adversarial relationship to start with. Or in the case of safety professionals, many times they're viewed as the safety cops. And if you just think about that yourself, what's your relationship to a police officer? If you're driving down the freeway, and all of a sudden you see a police car behind you, do they seem like a partner to you in keeping you safe, or do you check your speedometer and automatically slow down?
Right.
So the work is applicable wherever there are human beings. The models are applicable anywhere there are human beings. I happen to work inside of corporations. And then people like Jake take it and apply it to whatever area of life they're interested in, they're looking at, they're investigating for themselves.
Cool.
The ultimate goal of a corporation, now I consult to corporations, and every corporation, when it comes to health and safety, they have kind of two phases. Most corporations, like in a dangerous environment like the energy sector, they're in reaction mode most of the time. They're reacting to events and incidents, and there's always a breakdown in communication. The culture isn't mature enough to actually start behaving in a way that is economical, and working safely is economical to corporations these days. So most what corporate's goal or corporation's goal is to get to a proactive state, a proactive culture where they're no longer reacting to people getting killed or getting arms amputated or fingers, where they're actually developing and putting conversations in place that is stopping all this from happening. It's just a cheaper, more economical way. And that's kind of the incentive to corporations. When I apply that to, this is one of the biggest ideas in my mind, why I reached out to you, Tom, is a lot of us as podcast listener, ex-Mormon degenerates or whatever our title is now.
Right.
We are still in reactionary mode. We're still trying to learn how to adjust to losing or stepping away from our heritage or our belief system, or we're admitting we're wrong. We're stepping back and going, okay, what now? Well, what popped into my mind is, what tools do we have to be proactive instead of trying to laugh it away or we've gone through all this therapy with each other, laughing and digesting. What can we do to get into proactive mode instead of waiting for Mormon people to come to their own sense, to come to senses or come to their sense? What can we do to be proactive, to reach out to them, to start having conversations that they're not throwing their defenses up and that they can look at us and say, hey, these apostates are people too. They're decent right. people. They haven't changed. They haven't grown horns or.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's one of the things that I remember when we were at lunch, I was talking to you about this. The whole idea of building bridges rather than burning bridges, because it seems like burning bridges is almost like an unintentional consequence of when these worlds kind of collide, you know, like in my marriage, I was the dynamic changer, you know, I was the one that left the church. And so in a lot of ways, these gaps were being formed between us. That I didn't intend to happen, but from her perspective, it was perceived that I was creating these chasms or rifts between each other. And then, you know, I set up camp in my little world and she set up camp in her little world. And then we have these areas and gaps between us that almost seems impossible to find ways to negotiate and find common ground. So I am curious, Kim, what do you think about? I mean, have you done a lot of work between like religious belief to disbelief and disaffection and seeing how these worlds kind of collide and how they can compromise? Is this new to you, or have you seen this before in other places?
I have never directly worked with it. In a relationship or so, I can't say that. I have seen people use some of the materials to investigate areas of their own lives, just like Jake did. So, you know, one of the things, Tom, is that if we look at some of the basic perspectives I bring to the table, I would say that an individual, a marriage, a relationship, an organization, a society, a church, anything you take is a network of conversations. And there are certain conversations within that network that move the individual, the couple, the organization, the society forward inside of its intended purposes and results. And there are other conversations that actually stall or undermine it. Many times we're unaware of the conversations that we traffic in and the impact of those conversations on ourselves, our lives, and others as well. So my work is around people waking up to and becoming aware of how their conversations impact themselves and others, as well as the organization. Once we're aware of it, we can actually find ways to navigate around it. So one of the things that's been in here in the conversation already that we can bring a model to, for instance, is this thing about coming to a conversation with a perspective. Well, you and I as human beings, we can't help but having a perspective as we enter into a conversation. It comes with us.
Right.
What's useful is to be clear about the perspective we're bringing prior to going into the conversation. If we're unaware of the perspective we're bringing, it is reality. We can't distinguish anything outside of that for ourselves or others. If we're actually clear that we're bringing a perspective already, we can start hearing and seeing things that are outside of that perspective.
It sounds like you're saying that we need to be self-aware enough of our own biases, right?
That's a great way of saying it. That's a great way of saying it. Because what our biases gives us an ability to see certain things. But at the same time as we see certain things, if we're just standing in front of each other, you and I, Tom, you're standing looking at me, I'm standing looking at you, there are certain things you're going to see that I don't see.
Right.
You're going to see everything that's behind me that I can't see. I'm going to see everything that's behind you. Now, some of the time, or a lot, most of the time, I would actually suggest, we relate to each other and we converse with each other from a perspective that we both see and understand the same thing. So instead of building bridges, we're talking about, and kind of our perspective in the background is, well, Tom must be really strange. I mean, I see all this stuff right behind him, and given he must see that too and understand and know that, given he's come from that direction, why is he behaving the way he is?
Right.
He's just a really strange creature.
I would agree with that.
Right? And yeah. And so then whatever you're saying, I'm listening to whatever you're saying through this really strange creature or interpretation of the strange creature I have in front of me. And I'm actually not hearing what you're saying. And I'm missing what you're saying that may be right behind me, like the bear or the tiger or the wolf.
Kim, I had drawn the little, I went and borrowed a pen from the fast food place. And I drew the little, remember the little rectangular box where yep. this is you, this is me, Tom?
Yep.
I drew that for him, and I know he was like, what the crap is this? But
no, but it's a good visual representation of seeing that we all have blind spots. And I think that's what you're saying,
absolutely.
Kim, is
we do.
We come into a conversation or when we meet people, there are blind spots all around us and vice versa. You know, that person's coming to the table with their own blind spots.
Yep.
Can I chime in real quick just to give a real world example in my life
sure.
of how that's a help. That just knowing that one little thing right there has helped me so immensely with my relationship with my wife. Because, I mean, Kim, I know that you don't know women very well, but they're crazy creatures for the most part.
Believe me, I have plenty in my family. I have plenty in my family.
Okay. So my
and by
wife,
the way, hold on one second, Jake. I'm not saying that men are any less strange than women.
Touche.
Yeah. So one of the things, so my wife isn't aware of any of this. I've tried to share it a little bit, but just understanding that one concept has made me just be a little bit more deliberate with how I communicate with her. And she'll see red and I'll see yellow. For example, and we'll have conversations and she'll just be dead set that Jake, you're wrong. Maybe I'm wrong 80% of the time, but when she won't give me that little 20% that I've earned,
right.
It's upsetting, but
yeah.
Instead of getting upset right back at her, I've stopped and I held my hands up in the air and said, wait a minute, you're seeing something I'm not seeing. And I'm okay being wrong. I don't care about, I just want to understand what you're seeing because I'm not seeing it. So please just walk me through why this is red to you. Because in my mind, from my perspective, this is blatantly yellow. And the 20% of the time that I'm right, I usually can get my wife to say, we'll start walking through it and explaining it. And then she'll get to a point and go, yeah, this is yellow, isn't it? And I clap my hands and go, I didn't even have to fight with her. I just had to be okay being wrong where her defenses drop. And then we start having a conversation about it. And then she says, yeah, our car is broke down. It won't start. Or whatever the topic is. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, well, I think to her credit, too, it sounds like, sure. You know, she was given space by you, and I'm just assuming here, but that she kind of came around, right?
Yeah.
Where she's like, okay, I'll take a second to try to see your perspective. And I think that's probably the one thing that I really want to maybe discuss a little bit is this ability to be able to see through each other's blind spots, to understand, what is it, empathizing with each other? If you take yourself out of your own shoes and really try, obviously you'll never be, you know, able to really understand or see what the other person's experiencing and what they're saying. But if we try, that's a step, right? That's what's helping. And I was reading a book the other day, and they were saying how crucial empathy is for society and for the human race. Because if we don't strive for empathy, then we're never going to come to a mutual understanding. You know, that's how we break down racism. That's how we break down homophobia. Because if we can actually understand those people that we don't understand, then that's what's going to break down those walls.
So, interesting. You're getting into a whole round here. It's my nephew just came out, and it's been an interesting road in terms of that. And this is very much the conversation that's up that I'm now having with his parents about, or want to have with his parents about, the distinction between acceptance, understanding, being treated as equal. It's the truth is, I personally, this is me personally, Tom, and I'm not going to speak for anybody else, but
okay.
I don't know that I will ever understand certain things in life or other human behaviors or why they're prone a particular way or why they believe something that in my world is so lunatic, even. I don't know that understanding is the thing to work towards.
Okay.
For me, accepting that they have a different point of view, that they're different than I am, loving them for who they are and respecting them and treating them as an equal with the same rights as I have, that's different. But I can do that, and I still don't have to understand.
Interesting. It's interesting because, you know, and I can appreciate what you're saying, but don't you think that, and maybe I'm just perceiving, maybe I'm projecting this, but like even with the Orlando shooting, the recent yep. Orlando shooting, that in the media, there's such a wave of trying to really dissect what was the motives behind this guy. Was it strictly homophobic? Was it something else? Because I've heard recently that maybe he was closeted gay as well.
Right.
Maybe there was all these other things. It seems like there's just this wave of motivation to really try to understand what that person's motivations were. And sometimes I feel like I guess I get sucked into that tornado, right? Where it's like, I need to understand as well. But when I'm listening to what you're saying, maybe you're right. Maybe we all need to take a step back and not really try to understand so much. Maybe we should be striving more for just acceptance.
Well, if I took what you just said and I put it into one of the concepts, again, that I work from. So one of the things is that I open any program I do in any corporation, in any setting, with any organization, with one of the things that I say is, I am not here to teach you anything. I do not have the truth on my side. We are going to look and explore certain things together, and I bring a certain perspective. It's up to you to look and see how this applies for you and in your work and your life. But if you're thinking that I come with the truth, then we need to do some other work first. And the basics for that, Tom, is that our society and our world has been built on rewarding people for having the right answer. One could say that also falls in the domain of understanding. You know, if you understand multiplications, you'll know that 2 times 2 is 4. You know, if you understand physics, you'll understand, you know, E equals MC2 square, whatever that is.
Right.
Right. If you understand, and that is an answer-filled world, I think there's a lot more value in actually staying in a question, like an inquiry, and looking at something to see what you can discover. But we are so driven to have an answer that it actually stops the inquiry. You know, so if we go to the Orlando shooting right now, you know, the people that you have one side that is for gun control, and on the other side you have the NRA, which is against gun control based on the Second Amendment. And you now have two opposing forces against each other arguing for who's right and who's wrong, rather than people actually stepping back, like you're saying here, and taking a look and going, what is going on? What is it that has this occur time and time and time and time again in the American society? You know, there are other societies that had mass shootings where they actually don't occur anymore, or at least do not occur at the scale that they do here in the United States. But it's interesting because in the United States, I don't know if you're aware or not, but the CDC is not even allowed to do any research on gun violence. And if we look in the disease world, study the phenomena of killings by gun violence in the United States. The CDC cannot look at it. So if you take it, you know, another area where people are killed at a large scale, automobile driving. And the CDC has been able to study it. Laws have been passed, regulations have been passed, which has made the world of driving safer. But when it comes to this, it's one of those things where, like Jake said earlier, people are so positional that they can't even hear or listen to what's on the other side.
It's the sacred cow. Nobody's wanting to actually announce the sacred cow in the room.
And actually stop back and start looking at it. You know, I was in a conversation with somebody else the other day about that particular thing, and you know, when it comes to that world, I am for gun control. I grew up in Sweden, and, you know, to get a license to have a gun over there takes an act of Congress, basically. You know, you know, when they have to be stored certain ways, there is incredible laws against it, that comes with weapons of that nature. And you certainly cannot get an automatic or a semi-automatic weapon as a civilian. There's no reason for a civilian to have that. That's my background. So I come to this society with a pretty strong opinion in that domain that, you know, it's, yes, the Second Amendment says a well-armed militia, you know, that's different than every single individual being well-armed. But that's my opinion, you know. And opinions don't move anything forward. So when it comes to the topic that Jake started with, which was verbal jiu-jitsu, one of the things that we're also unaware of is what are the types of conversations that can actually move action forward. And one of the first things I would suggest people have to do is to start looking at and being willing, and this is a key word, and I don't know if you remember this in the conversation we had about right, wrong, Jake.
Yes, sir.
But I love it when he calls me sir.
Oh, sorry.
So old. It's one of those. I know it's a heritage. It's a heritage thing, and you know, but you got to realize in Sweden, it's like we're very informal. And the first time I was called sir, I think I was 26 years old, and I'd started working in Texas, and somebody called me sir, and I looked at him, and I'm like, what? Who are you talking to? But anyway.
Yeah, you remember me telling me I used to get beat if I didn't say that. So
yeah, right, it's exactly. It's a habit. But what I was going to say is you have to be willing, and the key word is willing, to be wrong about your view of the world. If you're not willing to be wrong about it, then you've got a position and you actually cannot hear anything from any other position that may illuminate something that could be in your blind spot.
That is powerful. But would you be willing to admit, too, that that's a tough pill to swallow? for people.
Oh, no kidding. And one of the things I say, and I don't know if you remember, Jake, it takes an enormously big person to be willing to be wrong, even when they know they're absolutely 100% accurate and correct.
Say that again, Kim.
It takes an enormously big person to be willing to be wrong, even when, let's say, when all is said and done, you actually do discover that they were actually accurate. To be knowing that you actually are right, but to, in that situation, be willing to be wrong takes a big person.
Wow. So what would you say, like, of all the people you've met, is there a large percentage of people that you've met that have taken that leap, that have swallowed that bitter pill of admitting, okay, maybe how I was raised wasn't, you know, maybe everything that I've taught wasn't, you know, the way the world is actually designed or how it's actually formed? Because it was, I mean, I know Jake probably feels the exact same way I did. I mean, my paradigm was completely changed when I had to accept that bitter pill of, okay, maybe the church isn't true for me. Maybe everything that I did believe isn't what I thought it was. And once I looked myself in the mirror and I looked into that abyss thinking, okay, well, if it's not, then what does that mean?
Right.
And then the whole, you know, my whole world is turned upside down. Now I don't know anything. Instead of having certainty, now there's just questions. You know, an infinity of question marks everywhere. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Which is, it's, oh my God, I'm actually thinking of a poem right now that I used to have sitting in my office, and I'm looking around for it. I can't get my hands on it right now, but it is about descending into the deep abyss, and the deeper you go, the darker it gets, and eventually you end at a staircase. There is a complete abyss, and from that abyss arises your life. So, sorry, Tom, I kind of went off there, but
it's
you're much more alive today living in the question than you were when you had the answer.
Yeah, but it's such a painful journey to get here. Yeah, you're right.
I did not say this was a painful. I nowhere right. in my introduction or anything did I. So your question though was what's the number of people? Well, so again, remember, I work in corporations, so I may be working on in the field of safety, or I'm working with a finance organization, or I'm working with, you know, a team that needs to work more effectively together, or like I'm currently working with a non-for-profit who, in the world of non-for-profits in Houston today, which is where I live, you know, there are some challenges when their biggest donors, income have been cut in half in some cases, given they're in the energy sector, you know. So whatever area I'm working in is inside of a corporation. There, it's probably a lot easier for people to look at things and be willing, like you're saying, like I'm saying, they're willing to be wrong and actually give up certain positions or positionalities and look. Jake, in this case, he took all of that and has, you know, applied it to something that is fundamental to his life and his religion. How many people do that? I don't know. But the ones that do, they do come to a place where, you know, they are the creators of their own universe. And they're clear that the blame game, which is where we come to a conversation and we try to be right and make others wrong or dominate and justify ourselves and avoid the domination of something or someone else and invalidate them, is simply a posturing where what we lose out on in the same moment is the very thing we as human beings want, which is love, affection, respect, closeness, affinity, all of those things.
Connection.
So connection, being connected. Yeah. Like one human being to another. So going back to, I love that word, connected, you know, because you can feel connected to another human being without understanding their religion, their philosophy, their sexuality, their orientation, their whatever. You could actually be connected to another individual.
Culture, race.
Any of it.
Yeah.
You know? And sometimes it happens in the most tragic situations, you know, where, you know, somebody is at the end of their time on this, in this realm, and there is a certain presence there, whatever you call that, you know, and all of a sudden you're connected, but you're connected to another human being. So if we looked at the world as what we all desire is really to be connected to one another, then it's really interesting all these barriers that we put up that keep us from being connected.
That's interesting.
Can I? Sorry, Tom.
Go ahead, Jake. No, go ahead.
I'm backing up a little bit. When Kim stepped into a world, when he stepped into my life, when he was introduced to us as this high paid, super smart consultant that was going to teach us how to talk to each other, we kind of already had our own private discussions of laughing him out of the room already. And I was mesmerized by, from day one, how he took such a crowd of people that was so different than him. He walked into middle of Wyoming in bedazzling jeans, and part of me was like, I'm going to have to protect him. He's going to get killed in Wyoming.
That was not the first session, Jake. I did not have my bedazzles on the first session.
So one thing he did say in that first meeting was, this is a safe place. Like, I don't care what you say. You can say shit, hell, damn, whatever. We're in a safe room. Whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, basically. And we're gonna get present. We're gonna really get out on the table how we feel about each other as a team. And he was able to milk that out of us. And we found out that we didn't like each other. We got real present with each other. And then before it went fist to blow, we started throwing blows at each other. He backed us off and said, "Let's talk about it. Let's put all this on the table in a productive way." Does that make sense? And I have never, the one time in my life, well, my, I don't know if you remember, my pop passed away right in that time period, Ken.
Yep. Yes, I do.
I remember sitting in a room with the group, and one of the individuals kind of got emotional, and I'm a pious, big tough guy, or at least I thought I was. And out of nowhere, I just got super emotional, and I didn't even know why. I literally had to go outside for about 20 minutes, and I was doing that whole 4-year-old, I stubbed my toe. I just couldn't get control of myself, and I couldn't believe how much of myself I was holding back, how much I wasn't living in real life and being present, how much emotion I had built up. And I think that goes to what you had said, Tom, how many people really do this. This is the hardest damn thing in the world to do, is to really evaluate yourself, especially when you put it in a Mormon context or whatever context we're in as human beings. We feel like victims. We feel like the church has done this, and we're victimized. We've been sold a Hallmark card, when the real story is this guy is just a complete creep, or our history is so non-credible and it's damaging. But how do you step out of that victim box and stand back and go, okay, what part do I have to play in this? If my family, my culture is important to me and being a positive part of that culture, what part do I play in this? That's the hardest thing in the world to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I would agree with it. As we've been talking, I often do find myself, being a champion for people to become more self-aware, to really understand themselves in a much more objective sort of way. But it's always like, I want to give that caveat, like it's going to open a can of worms for you too, because you'll see a lot of your flaws. You kind of have to work through a lot of those issues too. But I think you're right, Kim, because when you were saying that it opens the world to you, you look into that abyss and then eventually you start to see the staircase. And I think that's right. You start to build the world on a much firmer and much stronger foundation. And like all the colors are more brighter, all the flavors, taste better. I really do think that, even though it is kind of a difficult journey to go on. But I also want to ask, for those of us, and I do mean everyone in humanity, how do we avoid the pitfalls of being aware of our blind spots, or getting out of the traps of certainty? How do we do that?
So Tom, it's when I first started this journey for myself. So I didn't grow up in a particularly religious home. But I grew up inside of a social democratic society that had been basically, the social democrats have been ruling the country and been in government for the last, I think, 60 out of the last 80 years or something like that.
This was in Sweden,
this
right?
is in Sweden, exactly.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a steel mill and lumberjack town, lumberyard town. That was my background. And at the time, I was working in a restaurant, and really, what was available to me as a future, I thought at that time, was if my boss potentially opened a restaurant in Stockholm, well, then maybe I could move there and work in that restaurant. In the realm of what I saw possible for my life, that was all that I could see. Why am I saying that? Well, I'm saying that because at that time in my life, when I first started looking at this for myself and really the parameters of my life and my thinking, because one could say that what we're talking about is, what is the parameters of your own thinking? If a belief that you have is reality for you and not a belief, then you can't question it. And you have to simply relate to it like it's real, whether it is or isn't, is irrelevant at that point. And you've lost your own ability to investigate and inquire.
Right.
Right? So yep. I consider myself lucky enough that a friend introduced me to what was then a personal development program back in 1982, I was 17 years old, and I walked into that program. It was 2 weekends at the time, 3 evenings, I believe, and it was like somebody took me out of the petri dish and gave me a superficial perspective, like took me above my own life and had me observe myself for the time of the program, and observe myself bumping into the limits of my own thinking, and then put me back in my own self. I don't know how else to describe it, right?
Right.
But once you've observed yourself at doing that, you're like, when you're back in your own life, you're bumping up against these things that you never saw you bumped up against before. Like, then you start examining them. There's a kind of a fable about how you train fleas. And if you catch fleas and you put them in a jar and you put a lid on the jar, they will keep jumping and they'll keep hitting the lid. Well, after a while, the fleas will actually learn that if they jump that high, they're going to hit this thing. So they stop jumping. They start jumping just a little bit lower than that. Well, if you leave them in there long enough, and then you eventually take the lid off the jar, they still won't jump out, even though they can. Because they've been conditioned that if you jump that high, you're going to hit the lid.
Program.
So, yeah, they've been programmed, right? So, I forgot what your question was, Tom. And why I went down that route.
No. The pitfalls of our blind spots.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it is. It's the more you look at yourself, the more you actually are willing to investigate, sometimes the harder it gets. But at the same time, it's I find it's where aliveness, where invention, where really the true joy in life comes in. You know, the joy where... Do you ever wish you had a child's eyes again? You know, one of those that the first time they see snow,
yeah,
you can just see the fascination and the wonder in their eyes.
Yeah, and the world's full of possibilities,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. The world, right. It's just, you can go out and you smell something for the first time, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, go down a water slide, and that was the best thing ever.
Right.
Right.
I mean, and you could do it again, you know?
Yeah, right.
It'd be the best thing again.
Why is not everyone doing this? Yeah, right.
Yeah. And we get conditioned as we grow up to be more what I call, quote unquote, mature. But it's really less alive. But with aliveness comes chance.
Well, and having to admit you're wrong, there's that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So can I chime in real quick?
Sure.
Sure.
So Kim right now is perfection. It's the, how do I say this?
I know what your question was, and I'm going to answer that. Sorry. Yeah, keep going.
When I'd sit in these classes with Kim would just pontificate. Uh-oh, did I lose you?
No.
No, you're okay. Good.
He would just go on these, get me up in the clouds, and I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? And I would feel all these, like, this is amazing, but I'm like, how is this, what does this have to do anything with reality? Like, this is not the real world, dear. There's real problems in the world, Kim. We're up in the clouds with Dumbo flying around with big ears and, but is any of this stuff work? And just to give you a black and white example, he took a group of 8 people as part of a safety group. In 3 years, I think you made back that company their money tenfold. Or we did, didn't we, Kim?
It was actually 257 times fold.
Okay. So in three
wow.
We could track on a dollar amount what they were spending on people getting hurt, on the gaps in communication and the clarity of policies. And we were able to turn that whole safety culture around just by having conversations with people, just by applying a few of these little principles. We were able to bridge gaps, not we, but the whole group out there. We were just a catalyst for it. And we tracked millions upon millions of dollars of improvement in a 3-year period. And we were at the top of the corporation. So I know all this sounds like it's a, but this all translates into a very tangible, productive item when it comes to culture, changing culture. Sorry, I just had to chime in on that.
No, that's and that's actually true. There was a university student, a master student from the Copenhagen School of Business that just did his thesis on the work we did in Wyoming. And at the time I started working with the team, their what's called their total recordable incident rate was 1.0 I don't have the numbers in front of me right now,
but it was two point something, wasn't it?
No, it was 1.41 or 1.61 when I started. It had been worse before that, Jake, some work had already been done. By the time we were done, it was at 0.16, which means that the rate at which people got injured out in the field was much, much less, and there is a certain cost to each one of those. But anyway, the entire engagement over 3 years cost the company $350,000, I believe, and their savings was estimated to be between $80 and $90 million. So that's in dollars and cents how it translates. But going back to Tom, your question was how something around how do you do this, or how do you kind of get to that point of being open? And I got to admit this. So when I first participated in anything and started investigating myself, if you want to call it that, when I was 18 years old, I actually did think that there was one day I would arrive where actually I'd be outside of the blame game. I wouldn't be playing it anymore. I would be, you know, I would be above it. I would have transcended or whatever, arrived, whatever you want to call it, right?
Right.
And the bad news is the more I do it, the more I realize there is no arrival.
Well, that's a sad revelation. It's like, hey, there's no ribbon at the end of the journey. Okay.
No, it's but it goes to actually, and I looked up the quote that you reminded me of, Tom, and that's it's actually from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And what he said is we must try to penetrate our most secret self and examine our being from all sides. And so the first time in my life, perhaps, although I am supposed to meditate every day, I took the lamp and leaving the zone of everyday occupations and relationships where everything seems clear, I went down into my innermost self to the deep abyss. Hence, I feel dimly that my power of action emanates. But as I move further and further away from the conventional certainties, you could say beliefs, by which social life is superficially illuminated, I became aware that I was losing contact with myself. At each step of the descent, a new person was disclosed within me, of whose name I was no longer sure and who knew no longer obeyed me. And when I had to stop my exploration because the path faded from beneath my step, I found a bottomless abyss at my feet. And out of it came, arising I know not from where, the current which I dare to call my life.
That's beautiful. That's really, really great.
So, you know, the question is, whose life are you living?
or do you want to live life more fully, right?
Right. And, you know, I happen to work in the domain of corporations, where corporations are dealing with issues or simply want to elevate their performance and take it to a new level. Initially, the organization I was working inside of with Jake, we didn't come in there to work on safety. We came in there to develop their future leaders. And again, that's where we bring the conversation, the perspective that perhaps leadership lives in the conversations. So how do you actually have people have the conversations that make a difference and move the organization and the team forward inside of its intended purposes and results?
One thing you need to know, Kim, is most of the people that are going to be listening to this know what it means, the W and the line underneath it that you questioned us on.
Right.
Tom, I don't know if I told you about that, but he...
Remind us.
He put a... Beginning of class, he'd put a W on the wall on the whiteboard, and he'd put a line under it, and throughout the whole class, say, what is that? Every time somebody would say, well, how do you do that? Leadership will push back at you, or that's against policy, or And then they would get real adamant about, well, this is the right thing to do, but we're getting blocked or whatever. And you keep pointing at this W that's underlined. Finally, at the end of the class, what is that? And he's like, you're not going to do anything. You're not going to progress or be in generative mode if you're not willing to put your ass on the line for something. So make a stand. And most of the people listening to this can have done that. They've put their tail on the line to make a stand for something that they feel is right and wrong, or that they feel is the right thing for them, I guess I should say. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And the thing I would encourage is to keep looking at, you know, it's how do you, and I think, Tom, you're the one who said it, build the bridges so that you don't lose the connection, the love, the people in your lives that have been there. You know, now, I don't advocate hanging around somebody that's abused you. You know, that's not a healthy relationship. You know, however, neither one of you probably have been married to who you've been married to for as long as you have, because you didn't love them. You've actually been married to them because there is a genuine affection, attraction, love, appreciation, respect, and all of that there. And you may have different beliefs at this time. How do you keep the relationship potentially, and the love and the respect and the joy of your relationship, even though you have two completely different beliefs at the time?
Tell us, Kim, how do we do it?
Well, I wish I had the answer, Jake. You know, but if it looks like you're going to lose everything, then perhaps you're not as willing to investigate and inquire as if, you know, you could actually have it all. Potentially, you could have it all. And you may believe different things.
Yeah, you know, I host a mixed faith support group here locally where I encourage, you know, believing spouses and non-believing spouses, and we all come together and we meet. And one of the most painful, but I also think that it's one of the most important things that I say at the beginning of these meetings is I don't have any answers.
Right.
And just so you guys know, you know, I'll be sharing my experiences and my perspective, and that may or may not work for you guys. Each case is different. You both need to evaluate yourselves and each other.
Yep.
And find out what's best for you, because that's what I'm doing. You know, I take, you know, tidbits of advice and tips and tricks from other people. And sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, because my wife's a completely different individual than myself and a lot of other people. So you have to evaluate differently. And it's painful to actually say to some people, like, I think divorce might be the best option for you, you know, because it has such a negative connotation with it. You know, it's divorce. That means it's a failure or something like that. But sometimes that really is the best option.
And oh, absolutely.
And I think like what you said, Kim, you know, you got to keep everything on the table, you know, clean the table off. There's no certainty. There's no answers here. Let's build from what we've got, you know, and I don't know. I really, really like this.
No, and you're absolutely right. You know, and there is also a way to go through a divorce where there is complete, full and utter respect for the other individual and the other person. And right. The form of your relationship is changing. That's it.
Right.
The contract which you made inside of that, that's what's changing. You know, and contracts change all the time. People revoke contracts, you know.
Yep.
But it's interesting when you do put it inside of this domain of marriage. Now, a contract changing, you know, that is, you know, then you go into morality and failure and all that kind of stuff. But for some people, absolutely, it is the best thing, you know?
Yep. Well, I know we're kind of running up against it, but I want to leave some time if there's anything else that you guys want to share or talk about.
I don't have anything specific. If there's another conversation you want to have about certain more specific models and things like that, and Jake has mentioned the term of generative conversations, what we mean about that and what I'm talking about when I say that, I'm happy to do that. And perhaps that could be another conversation if people find this useful.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Jake?
I mean, Kim, you remember I'm a very literal mind.
Yes.
Like I've kind of come up with a hit list of three major items that I've used.
Okay.
Just like holding my hands up in the air and saying when I know, like, for example, in my father-in-law's or my wife's, my interaction with them in a conversation, just the non-defensive posture of holding my hands up in the air and saying, hey, I would love to be wrong, or I want to know maybe if you could talk a little bit about how do you pull those defenses down when you're actually talking with an individual that is defensive, that is entrenching. Is there any techniques or methods of talking with people like that, or is it just, if somebody's entrenched, you're just not going to have a healthy conversation? Or is there things that we could do proactively on our side of the fence to say, look, here's the white flag. I just want to talk.
Right. Well,
That's a hard one, huh?
Well, what I would say about it, so I can only kind of speak from my own experience, Jake. So, you know, whenever and you've seen me in the programs and things like that, and people from time to time do have very different opinions than what I'm presenting, or completely opposed or object to what I'm saying. So the first place I always look from is, so this is kind of a two-faced and so you have to kind of hold both at the same time. So one, they're not responding to me physically. They're actually not responding to me. There's something I've said that has triggered something over there with them. So that's one thing, right? I always got to keep in mind that really they're not responding. There's something in what I said that has stirred something, stirred the pot over there, if you want to call it that, right?
Right.
The next thing is that I'm 100% responsible and accountable for anything and everything that's showing up. So I'm at the cause and at the source of what's going on. It has nothing to do with them.
I own it, basically.
Yep.
Ouch.
So if somebody, if we use the term, needs to get off it, needs to alter the conversation, I'm the one who needs to alter the conversation. It has nothing to do with that. So I need to alter what I'm saying or how I'm saying it such that they could hear the intent of what I'm saying, rather than being stirred up.
Do you have an example in your mind?
I don't have an example right off at the top of my head. But I could probably use the example.
Go ahead.
If you don't mind, that you threw out at me when we were in the conversation about reality.
Okay.
And truth, right?
Yep.
So we're in this conversation about reality and what makes up reality. And I don't know, Tom, were you taught that if you prayed and you got a warm, fuzzy feeling, that meant God was responding to you or anything like that?
Yeah, manifesting the truth of all things. Yeah.
Oh, very good. Oh, great. Great. So, you know, I can very easily teach you and every single person who's taught that how to know and ensure that anything you pray on, God is responding to. Buy a ghost pepper from Trinidad and have a bite before you pray.
That'll set you up.
I can guarantee you God will respond to every single prayer if it's based on a warm, fuzzy feeling, right? So we're in this conversation and Jake, yes, is very literal, and he can also get very passionate, and if something doesn't agree with him, he can voice his opinion in a way that could be seen as confrontational by some.
He can be a little pissy. All right.
Right?
Absolutely. I'll admit. Right?
To the point of, you know, pounding fists. And by the way, he's not the only one, right? So we're in the conversation, and I'm suggesting that really there is, you know, first of all, there's no truth out there. You know, if we're looking for the truth out there, there is no such thing, and there is no such thing as right or wrong. And that thoroughly didn't agree with Jake at the time. You remember this conversation, Jake?
Absolutely.
So Jake said whatever he said, and we got into another conversation. So I had to look at, okay, how had I said whatever I had said such that Jake had that reaction, you know? And then I had to look at how could I say it differently so that he could potentially get into the conversation and hear what I was saying. You know? You know, if you look at the world, whatever truths we have today, they're not the truths of 200 years ago. You know, a few hundred years ago, the earth was flat. Well, that's been proven wrong today. You know, the question is, what is it that's proved that we live like it's true today that's going to be proven wrong in the future or incorrect in the future, right?
Right, right.
Right. So I think that's an example, you know, is I had to find different ways of talking about it, and sometimes bringing in historical perspectives and all of that helps, you know. But there is an individual test for what's real, and that is how you feel about something. What's your sensory, you know, what does your senses say about this? Now, what's interesting about that individual test is that it's highly unreliable, because if you notice, they do change from time to time. You know, one day you're madly in love with your spouse, and the next day you wake up and you go, God, how could I have married that bitch? What was I thinking? I'm sure that's never happened in your life, Tom. You know,
never once,
right? Right? What the hell was, you know? But anyway, that's an individual test, and it's really the most unreliable test for reality. And if you wanted to manipulate that test, yes, give every Mormon a ghost pepper and tell them to bite it before they pray, right?
Yeah.
Then you have what you could say is an interim test for reality, and that's if all three of us look at the same thing and we all say it's the same thing, then we've got agreement around it. So you could say an interim test for reality is whether we agree on it. And faith, religion, beliefs, you know, they're based on agreement. And the more people you get to agree on it, and the more degrees the people have that agree on it, the more real it becomes. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. It's kind of like if there was a car accident and there was multiple witnesses, you take each account and then try to garnish, you know, what actually happened, sort of thing, right?
Exactly. And if you have three people observing the same thing and it's the three of us, there would be at least be four interpretations of what happened, because
right.
I'm a Gemini, so I would have at least two.
Right.
Right.
Of course.
In the Mormon language, Kim, it would be the more fiber of your being that you have agreeing. Because every Mormon will say, I know with every fiber of my being. So the more fiber you have, the more intern agreement you have.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean it's for your colon. Yeah,
No. Although it could be healthy to have a lot of fiber.
Yeah, it would be.
Some of our beliefs, because some of them may actually go out that way. Right? Right? So, but the, yeah, that's great. The fiber of my being. Fiber, I'm going to write that down. I like that. and then there is, and this is where Jake really got tripped up in this conversation next. What one could say is the ultimate test for real. And the ultimate test is whether or not something has physical existence. You know, so I don't know if you're sitting at a desk right now. You know, you could actually physically feel that desk, right?
Right.
Or you're sitting in a chair. You know, you can physically feel that chair. And that's the ultimate test for whether or not something is real, right? Now, beliefs, you can't put that physical test to. Can you?
No.
Well, I suppose, like with prayer, and then you get the warm feeling if you didn't eat a chili pepper. Yeah.
Yeah, but then you're at an individual level.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Oh, and then if several people do the same thing and you get agreement, now you're in the interim test. But can you actually, right, when it comes to beliefs, and let's say right or wrong is a belief, can you actually give it that physical test?
No.
No.
So maybe it could be something to be questioned.
Pandora's box. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. And besides from that, you know, if you took the desk you're sitting at and you took it to, oh, did you ever see the movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy?
Oh yeah.
Where this little plane flies over the African Kalahari Desert and drops out a Coke bottle, and the local tribe has never seen a Coke bottle. So it must've been a gift from the gods. And whereas they never had possessions before, it was all communal living, all of a sudden they start fighting because there's only one of these things. Right?
Right.
So, you know, and it really, what was it? It was a Coke bottle to us. To them, it was a gift from the god, and it could be used in many different ways. Right? So what is it that says that the desk in front of you really is a desk?
Language.
That's deep, man.
hang in there, Tom. He's going to get to the...
Right?
Okay.
No, but it's... And that's really... Now you have to get to, well, it's really a desk because in language, in conversations, you and I agree on that. If we took it somewhere else, there could be a different agreement around it. So how do we really know what's real? Maybe we don't.
Maybe we don't. Yeah, great. That's definitely not the answer I was hoping for. Yeah.
but the key is it's language.
Right.
At the base of everything that we do, it's the language we use. Right. Like when your football coach said, we need to get back to basics. When we get back to basics, it's the language that we use to connect with each other and to make agreements with each other. And if we agree on love and empathy and mutual respect, it's the language that we use to achieve that. And the more that you can show alignment with other people, look, we both want the same thing. We both want to be loved. We both want to be respected. We both want to be cherished. There's no harm or fault in saying, if that's the language you hear that in, let me come your way and speak that language. And have some reciprocity and return it to me. Am I off on that, Kim?
Yeah, no. No, no, no.
And getting that deliberate with communication, that's something that we don't do proactively. Once we start becoming tribal and we separate ourselves to you're ex-Mormon and Kim's gay, and once we start throwing these fences up around the groups, quote unquote, we quit learning each other's languages and we're fighting over the terms that we use to describe our own reality.
Right.
So to me, what I took from all that, Kim, is I don't need to get so caught up in the language that I use or I define myself with. I need to be caught up in what I really believe in is a mission of life, and that's to connect and love each other. And whatever it takes, whatever language I can use to do that, that's what I'll do.
That's great.
No, that's awesome. That's I even think that might be a good place to wrap up, unless there's anything else.
No, I mean, you know, it's if anybody is interested in any of the work I do and how I can impact corporations, I'll give my website. It's www.accendio, A-C-C-E-N-D, as in dog, E, Edward O, Oscar, accendio.com. And people are welcome to send me questions, email me there, you know, request any information or whatever. And if you're ever interested in having another conversation, Tom, I'd be delighted to.
That'd be awesome. And I'll include that information in the show notes too. So
great.
When we put the episode up.
Hi, this is Nick from Los Angeles. And when I'm not spending time with my counterfeit family, I'm listening to Infants on Thrones. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.